Architects, designers, and planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients, on the web at www.ratioarchitects.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater. Information on the full line of Subarus available from Paul Moser or Kelly Wetherill, certified Subaru specialists. Email address, subaru@wardenmartin.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at wyll.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, Computers in You, this is a topic we take up once a month on the third Thursday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest. He is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter Kimball. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Where shall we start this afternoon?
Well, let's see. There are several things we can talk about. I would like to remind everybody, and I do this every time I'm on, to not let up on their security. There are continuous attacks, phishing attacks, attempts to steal the identity. Some common sense in keeping your software and your virus protection and your firewall and such updated can go a long way to doing that. And now you have to be aware of social engineering tricks so that if an email comes to you and it looks like it's from Aunt Tilly, and Aunt Tilly says, here, I've got a new little biography. If you're not really expecting it, don't click to open that file because it could well be something that will install things you would just as soon not have.
Yeah. Well, you know, phishing now has been around for a while, but it appears they're still able to hook us.
They are. There's a lot of money being made. It has apparently moved or is starting to move into significant areas of organized crime because there is so much money involved, billions of dollars perhaps. And there are even, I now not directly related with computers, but there are even some phishing scams that are dealing with telephone calls. Call us at such and such a number and, you know, update your account information. And even if you don't do that, if you just call, you may be getting an area code that looks like a U.S. code but is actually a code to one of the islands that has outrageously high tariffs. And by the time you get off the phone, you've just committed yourself to a $130, $150 phone bill.
Hmm. Well, you know, the Pew people, you know, the Pew.
Yes, Charitable Trust.
Mm-hmm. And they do a lot of surveying work. And, well, they have a subgroup called Pew Internet, and they conducted a survey earlier this summer and found that phishing is still a foreign term to many people.
Yes,
of those surveyed, 55% said they weren't really sure what the term meant.
Well, and of course, if you haven't heard the term before, it's phishing spelled with a PH rather than the F at the beginning. And it is, to stay sort of with the phishing metaphor, it's angling to get personal information, to try to get you to give an account number, to give your Social Security number. Ideally, they would love to have that because that's a Social Security number, a birth date, and a name is all it needs to take out credit cards in your name.
So if you get an email asking for any kind of personal information like that, it's fraudulent, delete it.
And companies, legitimate companies, don't send out requests saying, will you please come to our site and re-register because we've had a security breach. A lot of the, in a somewhat ironic and really negative sort of turn of events, a lot of the phishing companies are now, or a lot of the people who are phishing, I'll call them companies, they're not really companies, a lot of the organizations that are doing this, are playing on the fears that people have from reading about all the credit card thefts. So they'll say, we've had a slight credit card breach. We need you to log on and reconfirm your information. People think, hey, this must be legitimate because I read about that. Such and such company may have lost the security on 40 million credit card numbers. I'd better go there. The other thing is, even if it looks like a legitimate message from your bank or from a brokerage or from any place, you should never click on a link that is actually in one of these email messages. What you should do at the very least, and this is not a 100% guarantee of protection, but at the very least you should simply go to the browser and type the address, Internet Explorer, Firefox, Safari, whatever your web browser is, and type the address in manually, because the link that you see in an email message may not go to the same place that it looks like it's going to. That's easy enough to create a misdirecting email link. So it says, I'm going to socialsecurity.gov, but it's really going to wegotyou.com or something.
Yeah. What can we do to block these kinds of messages? Is there anything we can do?
Well, one of the most effective techniques is to use an email program if you're an individual, or to be part of an organization such as the university that has what are called spam filters. They look for various characteristics that are very common in emails that are non-legitimate, whether they are actually phishing emails or whether they're just emails trying to sell you stocks or sell you pharmaceuticals or whatever it may be. And many of those many of the email programs, Eudora, Microsoft Outlook and such, and others as well, have junk filters that look for the characteristics that often identify these. Those characteristics and the profiles that these programs use obviously have to be continuously updated because the companies or the people who are generating this try to work around them. But it will quarantine them, and you can then typically, in most of them, look through the folder and see if anything looks like it is really something that should have been allowed through. But most of them are now getting pretty good. You have relatively few false positives, so that it says this is junk, but it really isn't. There may well be a few false negatives, some things that get through that weren't quite tagged because the program wasn't sure of it. But that's one of the things in terms of the actual email that you get. In terms of the websites and the various pop-ups and the other kinds of spyware and adware, the thing to do is to have a browser or a utility on the browser that will block those pop-ups. So if you do get to one of these sites. The other thing is if you are in a site, and most of your mainstream sites aren't going to do this, but some of them will say, oh, we've got this wonderful free utility for you. It'll be this cutest little toolbar, or it'll be this handy little search. And yes, it will probably do that, but it may well have another payload, often referred to as kind of a Trojan horse. It does one thing, but it does something else too. The other thing that you have it doing is not something you want. And the other exacerbating problem of this is once you have a piece of this, we're not talking about spyware and adware and such, once you have a piece of this in there, it opens a connection so that more spyware can be brought in. So it may invite, it's sort of like, gee, we let this sort of rowdy person into our house and we went away and they invited 80 of their friends.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden it gets out of control. And that's why a good spyware, adware detection removal program, and there are a number that are free, would be good to use.
And how often do you update those, Peter?
Well, you can, it really depends upon your safe web surfing habits. I update because it is a very simple click of a button that goes to the site of the manufacturer of the spyware detection removal software. Every time I use it, which may only be, in my case, every 2 or 3 weeks because I don't get to very many sites that have that problem and I'm pretty well protected. But you could do it weekly. You could do it anytime you see a pop-up that came up that I don't think that should have been there, because that may well indicate. I had a friend, I mentioned this I think at one other point, but the friend has an 11-year-old who keeps visiting some of these sites. And I would go and we ran one of these spybot detection programs or adware, and it found something like 380 suspicious instances, got rid of them, checked 4 months later, had another 150.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you just do once. It's like virus protection. You don't do it once and say, all right, I've installed it, I'm set. You're set for whatever the viruses that were currently recognized at the time they made that program.
Yeah.
So those companies also have updates. And many of them, fortunately, now allow you to automatically update. You set an option, and it will, the next time you connect to the Internet, go out to whether it's Symantec or McAfee or any of the other virus detection engines and will say, ah, they're fresh updates. And you can even have it download the updates automatically behind the scenes.
That makes it so much easier.
And most people don't really want to take the time to sit there and run through a checklist of security items before they start surfing the web or doing various kinds of work.
I want to say that at my desk here at WYLL on the computer, I think the virus thing, I think it updates at a certain time every day or a certain time every week.
That's typically how they're set. It can, and frequently it's set so that it's going to do it sometime in the middle of the night. but it could really be just about any time. We have some computer labs, and we have it do it daily, like at 8 or 9 o'clock. And it's set so there's a bit of randomization, so we don't have all 20 machines trying to do it at the same time. But that's really the best way.
Yeah.
The same thing is true, by the way, for Windows or even Macintosh software, but Windows is more widespread, and so there are more security issues with Windows because more people are trying to attack it and break into it. And so Microsoft has what has been known as become known as Patch Tuesday. The first Tuesday, or perhaps it's the second Tuesday of every month, they'll release a whole series of security patches. But you can now, in modern versions of the Windows operating system, tell it to automatically go get any updates, install them. Don't bother me with the details, and it'll happen in the background for you.
Yeah, you know, I think my computer is doing that, and I never said it could do that, but it just is doing it.
Well,
it used to pop up, and it used to say, updates are available.
Yes.
Would you like to install them? And then you'd click, and it would say, remind me about this in an hour or 2 hours or something. And so you could do it that way. Now my computer, the message pops up as I'm closing down for the day. It says, updates are available. What would you like the machine to do? Go ahead and install them. And then the machine shuts itself down.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty handy.
It is very handy, and it's simply a settings on the Windows Update service. And you can even set it, and this was probably set by whoever is maintaining the machines here, but you can even have it set so that it doesn't even bother telling you about it. It just kind of does it in the background, saying, yeah, you don't want to even be notified? Fine, I'll just do it for you.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine, Computers and You, the topic we take up once a month on the third Thursday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest this afternoon. He's here to answer our questions about computers, to take your telephone calls as well. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. No one waiting at the moment. Good time to jump in and give us a call and talk with us if you've got a question, because generally what happens near the end of the program, we get a slew of calls. Peter Kimball is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And that toll-free number is good anywhere in the U.S. So if you're listening on the Internet, you can give us a call and join the discussion this afternoon about computers and you. Well, there are some Internet innovations that are unfamiliar to some of us, And I think we're beginning to hear more about them, and I'm beginning to become a little bit more comfortable with them. One of these is podcasting.
Ah, yes.
RSS podcast feeds. What the heck is it all about?
Well, this all comes about with the incredible popularity of Apple's iPod and now many of the other similar sorts of devices from other companies. And it turns out that in the simplest analysis, you can not only download iTunes or other music and play them on your iPod or other similar device, but if you can do that with music, why couldn't you do that with somebody's radio program or somebody? It doesn't even have to be a public radio program. It could be somebody who just likes to make their commentary available, and they don't any longer have to have a radio station and broadcast it. They can simply store it in a compatible format so that it can be downloaded into an iPod and then put it on the web and people can go and get it. It's sort of the audio version of what was called, and I'll toss out another term, web blogging.
Yeah.
Which is essentially writing commentaries, putting it on the web, and some of those blog sites, some of the bloggers are very popular. People look at them just as they would always try to look for a favorite newspaper columnist when everything was in print. And so this is just the audio version of that, because you can't really be reading a web blog if you're driving along the highway, but you can certainly be listening to an audio feed of some sort, and so you simply download it as if it were music. The RSS, the syndicated, really simple syndication is what RSS stands for, and it's a way of having programs that can handle it, and iTunes and others, the new version of the software, certainly do this. You don't have to actually go out and say, gee, I wonder if there's anything new on this site. They can actually bring the information, kind of push it out to you. So There's going to be a lot of it. There is going to be some dilution, though, because if there were just a few dozen or a few hundred web bloggers, you might pick a few. If there are 10 million out there, there's a fair amount of dilution. If there's a few good sites that are doing podcasting, that's great. But suppose there are 150 or 200,000 or a million out there, you may be a little bit lost in the shuffle.
Okay. Maybe we'll come back to this topic, but we've got a number of folks waiting to talk with us now on the telephone lines. Let's go first to line four, a listener on a cell phone on our toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
I just have a question. I just found you while I was driving along. And I don't know if maybe this is related to what you're talking about, but I have the Windows Professional model, or the Professional program.
Right, Windows XP Professional.
Yeah, XP. And when I installed it, all I had was, you know, the welcome screen would come up, and that would, and it'd go into the program. Now I get another screen that, you know, has my screen name and somebody else's screen name, which is my wife. And I never told it to do that or anything. Does it just do that by itself?
The short answer is yes, it can. What Windows XP will do, and there are a couple of versions of this. One of them certainly does it by default. There's Windows XP Home and there's Windows XP Professional, but they can both do this. They allow multiple people to have accounts or to be able to log into your machine. And what that means is that if one person has a favorite desktop, they've got certain shortcuts, they've got certain things they want on the desktop, they're the ones who will see that. And someone else who wants to use the machine, if they log on with a different name, or if you use the Windows utility to create a different name, can have their own separate set of favorites and shortcuts and things that will appear. And once you have more than one of those, what you're going to end up with is some way of making a choice who it's going to be who logs on. And as soon as you've got at least two accounts, you're going to either need to see that screen where you can simply click on the icon for you or for your wife, or you can go into the window control panel and tell it you don't want to see them all listed. You'd rather have somebody type their name and login screen. If you've used a Windows computer at work, probably that's the way it's done. What's your name? What's your password? You don't actually have to have a password. You can set it blank if it's in a place where nobody is likely to get into it. But yes, that will be done automatically, and you can have as many accounts as you wish.
Well, and how do you undo that? Because I didn't do it. All of a sudden, it just started doing it on its own. You know, I would come with a Windows welcome screen, and then it would whip up and show all my icons, and now it's, you know, it's doing the choice thing. Is there any way to get it back to the way it was?
Yes, and I can't recall off the top of my head on the machine I'm sitting in front of here at the studio was Windows 2000, but what you can do is the place you would start is the start menu, settings, and go into the control panel, and there will be one of the items in the control panel will be users and passwords.
Yeah, I've been there.
Okay, and once you're inside users and passwords, and I can't actually get into it at this point on this machine because you have to be an administrator or have appropriate privileges, but then you will be able to I'm logged in under, so I can't get in and tell you by looking at the screen, but you will be able to change the way in which, if you want to get rid of that totally, you could simply delete that user. As long as you have two separate accounts, as long as you and your wife, for example, want to have different screens, then you need to have the two accounts. If you delete the account for your wife, for example, you're going to be able to
go back to just the single.
Now, there may be another setting in there, and again, if I could pull this up, I would tell you. If I were sitting in front of my machine where I have access to that, I could probably tell you in about a minute. But that is where you need to start.
Well, that's what I'll do then.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, what I had last winter, this is on what you were talking about earlier, I got some form of telephone hijacking on my computer. I kept getting a pop-up that had a rather pornographic image, and then it kept saying, please wait while we prepare the plug-in. And then it said, do you want to delete this? And I kept putting moving the mouse to collect yes, but I didn't realize till later I had a horrendous telephone bill, and I finally got straight out. I got caught with an overdraft penalty at the bank, but I am getting the money back month by month by credit on my phone bill after talking with the AT&T people. So I'll eventually get all that money back. I won't have to pay a phone bill till a partial one in October. But apparently there was some problem. Then the phone bill said Mobile NL as the location. This is some kind of a pornographic site, and it was trying to dial up, and apparently it was staying on without my knowledge until I logged off the computer, so that's why it racked up such a high bill, and wonder what the situation is about that.
Well, that is a fairly common sort of a scam or ripoff. It is a rogue program that was downloaded. It could be part, well, it's really more than spyware. This is actually more of, well, if not a virus, it's certainly a program. The generic term for this is often malware because it's doing bad things to you. But if you are connected via a dial-up modem, as a lot of people are, then any program running on your computer can, of course, use that modem to connect to, as you typically do, to whoever your internet service provider is. But once you've gotten one of these rogue programs, which could have come from visiting a legitimate website and clicking on a link from it and not having the appropriate protection in place, then that program comes up, and as you've seen, it pops up these dialog boxes. And even if it says someplace, do you want to cancel this and click on yes, what that button is labeled is not necessarily what it does. But once the program is installed, it can, in the middle of the night, if your computer is on, call that number, and typically they will call a number that's out of the continental United States. Whether or not it's related to a pornographic site or not really is irrelevant to the fact that it can call often to a country or to a location that has very high phone rates. And if you're paying something like $10 a minute, $9 of that is going to whoever is providing that number back in the foreign country, and $1 is just going to the carrier. But according to the way our telephone tariffs are set up, as you well know, by default, AT&T or whoever your long-distance carrier is obligated to bill for that. Now, if it's clearly fraudulent, as in the case of your situation, you can talk to them, and after you hassle with it a fair amount, you can get them to forgive that or to credit it back. But that's another reason to have some kind of antivirus software, spyware blocking software, so that those kinds of programs that will do that dialing don't sneak up. I know a number of people who are still connected via dialing up, and they simply if they have a modem that's built into the computer, as many are now, they will simply, they've gotten burned once or twice, and they will simply unplug the phone line from the computer when they're not using it, just to make sure. Now, you don't have to be quite that extreme. If you're sure that there's, if you've got the appropriate protection in terms of spyware and adware and antivirus protection, but a number of these programs are known to do that.
Very interesting. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon and invite others to join us. If you've got a question about computers, give us a call. Peter Kimball, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. No one waiting once again, so if you'd like to give us a call, we'll get you right in. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL.
You know, Celeste, adding on to that last call just a little bit, of course, having your telephone line hijacked is not going to be a problem for those who aren't connected via a dial-up modem. But even those who are connected with a higher speed connection, like a DSL line or a broadband line, people wonder sometimes, where does all this spam mail come from? Who has enough time or enough computer power to do it? Well, the problem is that a lot of that is coming from individuals' home computers. They have no idea that they're doing it. It's not costing them anything other than computer time, but they've at some point gotten some spyware or some other Trojan or virus-laden software. And what it does is it essentially takes control of the computer behind the scenes. It doesn't do it in such a way as to shut down your computer or to do damaging things, because then you're going to wipe it out. You'll be aware of it. But what it will do is then it can sit there, and in the middle of the night or even in the middle of the day, it can sit there and be sending out emails, doing the processing to send out hundreds of thousands of emails a day or other spam messages.
So is a firewall a good idea?
A firewall is a good idea. A firewall is simply a program that can sit between, it's software, it's in the computer, although there are hardware firewalls as well, but whichever kind it is, it sits and it examines what's trying to be sent out. It also can examine what's trying to come in, but also important is what's being sent out.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the firewall programs, the software programs, for example, such as Zone Alarm makes one that's shareware and actually free to download for individual users and free to use. If you install that and all of a sudden some program says wants to communicate over the Internet, Zone Alarm and other such programs will say, this program wants to communicate, send a message out on the Internet. Is that okay? Well, if it's your email program, you figure fine. If it's some program you've never recognized, you may want to investigate it a little bit before you give it free. So the firewall is a gatekeeper.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if the guest has any knowledge of the recent spyware and adware that's in media files, like Windows media files or Real Player files. Will regular antivirus spyware stoppers pick up on that, or since they're in the media files themselves, will they get in under the radar? Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
I'm not 100%. I know what he's speaking of, and the problems with rogue software, spyware, adware, whatever it may be, that's sometimes now included with media files in many cases is due to flaws in the Real Player or in Windows Media Player. They have discovered a way of causing the program to behave abnormally and to actually execute a program to run this software that you don't want running instead of just playing the media file. Often that's done by overflowing some part of the internal computer's memory in a way that the program writers didn't think to check of, the people who had done Real. So, yes, virus. The net result of that can be sometimes detected if you've kept your virus definitions up to date. The other important thing is to make sure that from Real Players, from any of the companies, if you're running Real Player or if you're running Windows Media Player, go to the site and see if there are any updates available. And there were certainly updates posted for Windows Media Player and I suspect for Real as well, because I remember reading something about that.
Okay.
So, yes, it's, again, being a little bit preemptive on this, if you've already been burned, you can clean it up with antivirus programs and spyware and adware removers, sometimes fairly difficult for them to get all the last traces out, but then make sure that your media player, whichever kind it is updated, your virus software is updated, you've updated your firewall, if you've got a firewall, you've updated your spyware blocker, and it's a shame that we have to do all of that, but and in fact, there are some studies showing that if there's a little bit less use of the Internet now as a result of all of these recently publicized problems.
Really?
So, or at least the growth has tremendously dropped, more so than you would expect by some saturation, which is unfortunate. And it's difficult. It's a game of cops and robbers. It really is, because as technology is put into place to try to safeguard a person's computing and Internet experience, those who are making a lot of money by illegitimate uses are looking for ways to circumvent that, and it gets ever more and increasingly sophisticated.
Hmm.
So you can't really let up your guard, but you don't have to be paranoid about it either.
Okay.
The only way to purely protect yourself, which is what nobody really, very few people want to do, is you simply don't connect to the Internet.
Yeah. I have known people who do that, though,
mm-hmm.
actually.
And there have been some more people who have said, yeah, I don't really want to do this.
It's a lot to give up, though.
It is. And there shouldn't be any real reason. There are a number of legislative attempts to try to add more penalties. But, you know, if you've got the penalty, there are already laws against a lot of this stuff. And so somebody who is doing this anyway isn't going to necessarily be stopped by seeing that there's a law that says they can't do it or that has certain penalties, especially since many of them are outside the reach of laws in the United States.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Kingman, Indiana, on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I'm retired. I did it about 5 years ago, pulled the plug, and your program today is right on the subject why I will not buy a computer. I don't know if maybe it's the manufacturers that need to get behind it too somewhat, because oh, you know, the identity theft and all the other stuff that's coming down the line. Who needs that problem, especially at my young and tender age?
Well, that's you're not alone, although there are those who would argue that, that never using a computer might be going a little bit too far. It really depends upon lifestyle and the kinds of things you want to do. For example, being able to get an email from grandkids, perhaps, with photos and such, is a big argument for some people to maintain at least some connection. And with the appropriate safeguards in place, yes, you're always slightly exposed, but it's not nearly as risky as we may have let out. We've been sort of looking at a lot of the things that people that can happen to people just to try to get them to protect themselves. You'd mentioned the manufacturers trying to get together and the software manufacturers. They certainly are, but it is a moving target. Operating systems and browsers and email programs are much, much safer today than they were 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. But at the same time, the attacks on them are more sophisticated as well. And, of course, dealing with the Internet and online transactions is only one mode of identity theft. Identity theft is going along by people stealing credit card statements out of mailboxes. But your point is well taken. But if you have a relatively cautious habit, you don't click and open attachments, you don't download all sorts of things, passive surfing of the web and receiving of email from people is a relatively safe thing to do.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. And we don't mean to be scaring people to death here
afternoon. I come into this sometimes a little bit too strongly, and that's usually the case after I've spent some time cleaning up a couple of people's computer systems. So, you know, if they just be a little more careful, I wouldn't have to do that quite as often.
Yeah.
But the benefits that you get from it are still tremendous. And I've also got a number of folks who, and I fortunately, knock on wood, count myself among them, have never yet had a problem with any adware or spyware. It's been blocked. It's been stopped. It's been detected.
Yeah.
But that's because I'm proactive at making sure my everything is up to date in terms of protection.
Well, back to one of the benefits of computing, podcasting is such a great thing. You know, to be able to take something, a program like the Afternoon Magazine or Focus 580 or Media Matters from our own WILL website,
that's right,
or farming information from the agriculture page on the website, and download that and then take it with you wherever you're going.
That's right.
And you can listen to it whenever you want.
Portable player. In fact, this is all going to be podcast. Somebody can listen to this. And it is wonderfully handy. Before podcasting and before the Internet, you'd have to set up a tape recorder and record it and then play it back. Well, that could be done with a Walkman or something in the old days of audio cassettes. And then if it was online, you'd have to be listening to it or recording it, playing back. But now, anytime you wish, you can just download the archive, put it in your little portable player, stick it in your pocket, and listen to it whenever you may wish.
Yeah. Speaking of players, I think we're all familiar at this point with the iPod. At least we know what it looks like, and we see people around. It's one of the most popular gizmos out there, and it's made Apple a ton of money.
Oh, tons.
Are
yes.
there other players that people can use?
There are. There are a number of players that are more Windows-based. They are starting to get fairly competitive with the iPod, except that, first of all, Apple has such a tremendous head start, so iPod is by far the most dominant in the market. For a long time, the only way you could get iTunes downloaded from the iTunes site was if you were using a legitimate iPod. Now, initially, at least to Apple's chagrin, but there are ways that you can take the files that you bring down from iTunes and put them on other portable players. And the other thing that Apple has clearly done right is simply in their industrial design. I mean, the iPod is simply a very small, mm-hmm. cool, slick-looking item. It doesn't look clunky. Some of the other ones, when they first came out, were pretty clumsy-looking. The Apple engineers have done an excellent job at designing the interface. You can move through, pick the tunes, etc., except for the iPod Shuffle. And you can also very intuitively move around and store and record whatever information you wish. That's simply not as convenient, or it hasn't been on a lot of the other machines, but there's going to be a large upsurge in the cheaper, because iPod is not coming down in price. It has come down a little bit, and they've increased the capacities, but they've stayed pretty much rock solid. Their top-level machine is still, not counting video, is still around $300 or so. And it does more than the $300 iPod did a couple of years ago. So until there's really a lot of parity between the iPod and Dell's machine and various others, there's probably going to continue to be that fairly high price. Other devices, other technologies, for example, the Sony Walkman, we were talking about that, very expensive when it first came out, but very rapidly the prices fell down to commodity levels. We're not obviously there with the iPod yet and with portable players, but I think the time is coming.
Yeah. Well, this is something I've never done. How difficult or how easy is it to connect to your computer and download what you want and be on your way?
The software that comes with these, whether you're on a Mac or whether you're using an iPod, now Apple did decide, as long as we're talking about the originator of the concept, so I guess it's fair to keep talking about Apple. And they did, after it was first available only for the Macintosh, make an iPod with Windows-based software. Hewlett-Packard, another company, makes a version of the iPod. It is an iPod, but it's got the HP label on it. I don't remember quite what it's called. And they ship it with Windows-related software. Same functionality. And it's very easy. You just plug the thing in. The software allows you to pick which songs you wish. You can pull them off of a CD, known as ripping them off a CD. You can download them from an online store. You can control the quality with which you want to record it. You essentially have a trade-off. You'll be able to get a lot more songs on your device, whether it's an iPod or anything else, if it's a somewhat lower quality. If you want to go with a higher quality, you're not going to get as many, which is sort of an odd change because 20 years ago, everybody was concerned about, let's see if we can get the highest quality. It's now, let's see how many songs we can get on the thing. I'll leave for the listeners to decide how practical it may or may not be to have 8,000 songs on your iPod, because you're going to forget some of them there, and if you listen to them full time, you're not going to get around to them for a year or two. And now we can add podcasts. You could get an entire year's worth of Afternoon Edition shows. And, but, you know, are you going to listen to them all? Well, certainly going to listen to the Computers and You show, I suppose, if they're listening to this.
There you go.
We'll see.
I want to mention that on our website, WILL.UIUC.EDU, there is a page all about RSS, which stands for
Really Simple Syndication.
RSS podcast feeds, and so you can click there to load up your player with Focus 580 archives, Afternoon Magazine, Media Matters. And then if you're an agricultural listener, if you go to the agriculture page, you can pick and choose from which programs you want to hear or download on your iPod. I believe you can get the various reports that they do through the day. And then also, though, on the page on our website that is all about RSS podcast feeds, there are some podcasting resources listed. So if you want to do a little research, if you want to learn a little bit more about what it's all about, go to the WILL website and you can read quite a bit about it.
And once you start using it, it really is pretty simple. That Really Simple Syndication acronym. Syndication, of course, like a syndicated column, is something that you want to see fairly often. The really simple part is it's very easy to set it up so that your computer will go and download, if there is anything available, the most recent column or the most recent podcast of whatever resources you want to choose. There are some interesting copyright and digital rights management issues that are going to be coming down the pike with a lot of that. For example, on the WILL site, which you mentioned, you can get the podcasts of the locally originated programming, but you're not going to be able to pick up a podcast of the overnight BBC broadcast, at least not from WILL, because that's a copyrighted by BBC. And if anybody's going to make that available, it will have to be them. And there are going to be other issues, especially as both radio, broadcast radio and broadcast television make the transition over the next few years to all digital, and the analog signals go away, so it won't be AM 580 anymore. It'll be WILL AM, won't be AM at all. It'll be WILL digital, whatever it might be. And at that point, the originators of the content can start to include all sorts of information, often known as the broadcast flags, saying, we're not even going to allow you to record this unless we wish, or we'll allow you to record it once on one device. So we're in the wide open west, stage mm-hmm. of podcasting and of being able to ship media around. It'll be interesting to see how yeah. that comes down over the next few years.
Well, we've had a number of different generations of the Wild Wild West,
yes,
haven't we?
Yes, we have, and there's always going to be another one, it seems. And of course, we've had the good guys and the bad guys, and that'll probably continue as well.
And they keep coming along.
Yep. It would be so dull if that weren't the case.
Yeah. We've got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program, so if you've got a question about computers, give us a call. Peter Kimball, our guest, Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. The phone numbers, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area and you'd like to talk with us, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And I suppose one of these days, either David Inge or yours truly, we should do a program on digital rights management.
Probably,
where we
yes.
are.
There are a lot of things that could happen. There are basically two major sides, and the truth probably falls someplace in the center. On the one side, there's the content providers, the Motion Picture Association, the Recording Industry Association. On the other side, there's the freedom of speech organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation. One side wants to have total rights locked up. The other wishes to have it be as totally free for personal, non-commercial use as possible. And there are legitimate arguments to be had on both sides. It's a much expanded version of the whole argument about, is it, you know, what about all this downloading of music? Certainly the copyright holder, the artist, the studio should have some say in that, so people who have downloaded thousands of songs. But at the same time, if you've purchased a song legitimately, should you be allowed to make a separate copy so you can play it in your car? Well, most would say yes, of course,
yeah.
But that's going to be something that will be have to give an explicit permission to once the broadcast and digital rights management takes
and
place.
As I understand, one issue is going to be or is... If you buy something, how many times will you be able to play it?
That's right. Maybe you've bought it and it will expire after one playing or 2 weeks. One of the things, I know we're on radio now, but talking about television, a lot of people are using things like the digital video recorders, TiVo and such, and that's pretty wide open now. But once it goes digital, they would be able to say, all right, you can time shift this. That's why a lot of people use it. They can't watch or listen to the program at the time. But now they can set things saying you can only listen to it if you listen to it within 2 weeks. If you don't, it's gone. It will not play back.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of
like
things.
That.
I don't either, but that's one of the arguments that is being made by some of the content providers yeah. that there should be that a level of control.
Because if you want to grab a series or something, and it's long, and maybe you don't get around to getting it all viewed.
That's right.
For
that's
a while.
Exactly
you
right.
Pay
so
for it again.
We are very used to being able to use things that we have purchased or recorded that have come off the air for free forever. That may not survive.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of things to be decided, and it's going to probably be legislative. The Federal Communications Commission had mandated certain sorts of controls be included in new digital sets. And the Supreme Court overruled that, said you don't have the authority, so now it's going to go into the halls of Congress. But it'll be I think you'd find a whole series on that quite possible at some point.
Yeah, I wonder, could it wind up, you know, with the Internet today? There are some sites you can go and you can get things, you get free information if you sign up. You can read the New York Times, for example,
right.
on the web. However, if you want to view articles from more than 10 days or 2 weeks ago, you have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
Or some websites, you have to pay for the content from the get-go. You have to be a subscriber. So I wonder if there will be a range of possibilities.
I suspect there will be. It's in such a early state with strong arguments being made on both sides that it's going to be, for people who are concerned about such things, it's probably important to become aware of the issues and make your views known, especially since it's likely to be decided by the legislature and by Congress, let folks know.
Okay. Well, there we'll wrap it up. We're out of time. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I was glad to. Kind of a quiet afternoon, but we had a chance to talk about a number of things.
some good issues out there here this afternoon we got out on the table. Peter Kimball has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Computers and You is a topic we take up once a month on the third Thursday of the month. So maybe we'll see you in September, huh?
I'll look forward to it. And boy, it'll be nice not having it be quite as hot when I walk across the parking lot.
Greg Klein will be with us next month here on the Afternoon Magazine for Computers and You. It's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste, from the Chicago Board of Trade. By the way, Celeste, I was so interested in listening to what you had to say about digital rights management and audio that I forgot to print out, or actually I printed them out, but forgot to bring you the settlements from the Mercantile Exchange. They're on the printer if you'd like to go get them. Now,
let's go get them.
That's good deal. Let's talk about what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade rather than the Mercantile Exchange at the moment. Another down day there at the Board of Trade. The weather across the Midwest, upper Iowa, parts of Illinois getting rainfall, some thunderstorms, that continuing to trigger losses in the Chicago Board of Trade corn, wheat, and bean pits. Futures in the beans were down anywhere between 10 and 15 cents today. The corn off between 3 and 7.5. In the wheat pit, July futures, or rather their September contract, was down 6.25 today. Had a high of $3.30, a low of 3.25 1/4, and a settlement price at 3.27. They were down 6.25. And the December futures were off 5.75 today, $3.44. The high, the low at 3.39 1/4, and a settlement price at 3.42 1/2, down 5 3/4. March futures 3.56 1/2, the high, the low at 3.51 1/2, settlement price at 3.55 1/4, down 5.5 cents in the May contract, down 4.5 today, 3.61 1/2. The high, the low at 3.57, and May wheat settled at $3.61 1/2. Once again, it was off 4.5. July futures were down 5.5 cents at 3.61 1/2. From the corn pit now. Nearby SEPs, the high today, $2.37, low at 2.32 3/4, fairly narrow trading range. They were down 7.5 cents at $2.34. Trade is said to have been light across the Board of Trade for all contracts in all the grains and the oil seeds as well. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Normal, Illinois, about what that might mean to this marketplace and whether it can rebound at some time. December futures, 2.47, the high, the low at 2.43. December corn settled 2.44 3/4. Down 7.5. Of course, we'll talk with Dan at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today during the closing market report. That is Central Time. March futures now, 2.53 1/2, the high, the low at 2.49 1/2, settled $2.51 1/2, down 6 3/4. And the May corn, 2.56 1/2, the high, the low at 2.53 1/2, and a settlement at $2.55 1/2. They were down 5 1/4. July at 2.58 1/2, high, low at 2.56 1/4. Settled at 2.57 1/2. They were down 4 3/4. In September's, 2.54, the high, the low at 53. Settlement price at $2.54. They were off 3.5 for the day. September oats now $1.74 1/4. The high, the low at $1.71 1/4. And a settlement price at $1.74 1/4. They were off 1/4. And Dece oats were down 2 cents at $1.77, with the high at $1.77 1/2 and the low at $0.75 1/4. From the soy complex, beans were off 15 cents in the nearby August contract. The lead option high at $6.74, the low at $6.60 1/2. Settlement price there at $6.69 1/2. They were off 15 today. September's $6.77, the high, the low at $6.63 1/2. Settlement at $6.74 1/2, down 14 1/4. And the November beans, $6.83 high, low at $6.66. Settled at $6.79 1/2. They were down 15 for the day. January futures, $6.85 1/2, the high, the low at $6.70. Settled $6.82 3/4, down 13 3/4. And the March contract, a $6.78 high, low at $6.67. Settled $6.76 1/2, down 11 1/2 for the March soybeans for next year. May contract, 2006, $6.68, the high, the low at $58. Settlement price at $67 1/2. Down 10 cents for the day. Bean meal August contract, $2.13.50 on the high, the low at $2.09.50, settled $2.12.60. They were off $4.40. And the September's at $211.70, settlement price down $5 even, with a high of $2.12.20 and a low at $2.08.50. August bean oil, $24.40 the high, the low at $23.95, settlement price at $24.31. They were down 42 cents, and the September oil off 42 as well, with a high of $24.40 and a low at $24.02. Settlement price up on the high at $24.40. That September contract in the bean oil pit, down 42 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Livestock prices were mostly higher, the exception being live cattle. August feeder cattle, 107.90 the high, 107.05 the low, the settlement 107.87.5, that up 32.5. September, 106.15 the high, 105.25 the low, the settlement 106.05. That up 37.5. October feeder cattle, 104.80, the high 103.75, the low. The settlement 104.67.5, that up 27.5. August live cattle, 79.35, the high 78.75, the low, finishing at 79.12.5, down 30. October, 81.62.5, the high, the low 80.80, the settlement 81.47.5, that down 10. August lean hogs, 68.67.5, the high, 67.92.5, the low, 68.22.5, the settlement, that up 25. October, 59.15, the high, 58.40, the low, 58.85, the settlement, that up 45. December lean hogs, 56.65, the high, 56.15, the low, 56.40, the settlement, that up 35. And February lean hogs, 58.75, the high, the low, 58.17.5, the settlement, 58.70, that up 35. July bellies unchanged today, 69.40, the high, the low, 68 even, the settlement, 69 even, that unchanged. The Dow off 44 points at 10,645. The NASDAQ off 6 at 2182. The S&P 500 down 7 at 1228.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
John Kent from Troy, New York writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what is nougat, and does it have some sort of symbiotic relationship with its rich chocolate coating?"
Nougat is a reduced form of sugar that forms strong molecular bonds with chocolate. In doing so, it turns weak, flaccid chocolate into rich, dark, chocolatey nougat. Now, this isn't to be confused with actual rich, dark chocolate, which is only available to select Swiss bankers at their villas on Lake Como. Notice that candy manufacturers only refer to rich, dark chocolate taste. Well, this is akin to the difference between lemons and lemony taste, which are as far apart as a pig and a poke.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com or call 800-989-DUCK.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director today. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. An excessive heat warning is in effect from portions of west central and southwestern Illinois through 7 p.m. on Sunday, for much of southern Illinois and parts of southwestern Indiana until 6 p.m. on Monday, and for southern portions of central Indiana until 7 o'clock tonight. A heat advisory is in effect for portions of southeastern Illinois and for south central Indiana until 7 p.m.